Okay, so tonight's the last in the series of mysticism, and in my personal opinion, while these subjects can get out there a little bit, they're not mystical. These are really principles of faith of Judaism. So the three that we're going to do tonight, three subjects that we're going to cover in 45 minutes, are Mashiach, resurrection, and the world to come. So I'll welcome your questions as we go along. But so I don't see these. These are actually, the two of them are of the 13 principles of faith. You know, that Maimonides enumerated 13 principles of faith, which are the foundations of Judaism. And anybody who doesn't believe in those 13 isn't believing in Judaism. They're believing in some other group of thoughts that equals some other philosophy, but it's not Judaism. So the 12th and 13th are Mashiach and resurrection. The world to come is not one of those 13, but it actually is derived from one of those 13, which is reward and punishment. So so we'll look at those. So let's start with number 12, Mashiach. Mashiach, of course, means Messiah. Messiah is the how you say it in English. But Mashiach really means anointed one. So I'll tell you, when I first converted to Judaism, when I was 16, when I first was 14 and decided that I was going to convert, and I learned about this Jewish concept of Messiah, not Jewish concept, but that Jews are waiting for the Messiah. Like, that was the first thing that I learned, pretty much, that the difference between Jews and Christians is, for Christians, the Messiah already came, and Jews are still waiting. Like, which is not the difference, but that's what I first learned, right? So I decided that if and when the Jewish Messiah comes, I'm not going to believe in him because I don't want to be Christian again. I'm leaving that. So that was kind of, you know, an initial misconception. And then recently I was in Costco, and there's a, where we get our glasses. So there's a Christian man that runs the glasses thing in the Costco that we go to, and he loves seeing us. He wears a Jew, you know, a Israel-American flag pin, and he's a real Israel supporter. So one day, as a statement of solidarity, he looked at us and he said, you know, it doesn't matter when if it's the first coming or the second coming, but when the Messiah comes, we'll all worship him together. And I thought, no, we won't, because we won't be worshiping the Messiah. That's not a Jewish concept. There's no worship in our concept of the Messiah. So it's actually a tricky thing, because being raised in this country, many of us have a concept of Messiah that's Christian. And yet we know Jesus isn't our Messiah, but we still sort of have this Christian concept of Messiah and think about that Jewishly, or at least I've encountered people who think about that, and I've experienced that myself. So that's what I want to try to dispel here, is that our concept is completely and totally 100% different. So our concept of Messiah, first of all, is that is total that it will be a human being, a person, a male, that will be no more divine and just as divine as you and I, that the person will basically be, let's just pick a person, let's say a Gandhi plus, really. Somebody who has a strong leadership capacity, strong compassion, is a warrior, so is also physically strong and has demonstrated that, is a scholar. So somebody who's strong in all areas and is a charismatic leader. So somebody who will be able to bring us all to certain things. So the first of the certain things that the Messianic age will bring us to, which I think I have on here. How did I write it out? On the ones that I gave you. Is a homeland. So that's Messianic age. We don't have a Messiah yet, but Messianic age, it seems, is dawning, especially with this particular thing. So we Jews who were born in exile, who live in exile, who were born from people who are born in exile, who've been in exile for 2,000 years, kind of think of exile as being the usual state, right, of the Jew being an exile creature, when in fact we're not. We're in exile, and we're out of our environment. So we're just so used to it. It's been so long that we forget really what our proper environment is. So the Jewish homeland is our proper environment, but the Jewish homeland that we have today is physically located in the place of our homeland, but still isn't actually the homeland that it's supposed to be yet. So the return, the physical return of Jews to that physical space on the planet is the first layer of what needs to happen. So the The Messianic Age will begin with the return of Jews from all over the planet to that space.
Is there a certain amount of Jews that have to be in Israel? I mean, or I heard a rabbi once say 2/3 of all Jews needed to be in Israel for that to happen. Or is it all Jews?
So that's unclear. It does, it's just, I mean, there's lines and numbers that different people bring, and we can talk about that also in terms of resurrection, and there's all kinds of different paradigms. So where we can say those kinds of formulas, and there are so many of them, really what we need to understand is what is driving the formula. So that all the Jews from all around the globe are returning en masse to the land of Israel is definitely one of the fulfillments of the prophecies of the Bible and heralds the Messianic Age. So how many? Right now we're getting up there. There's never, ever, 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 ever been anything like this ever in the history of the world. So it's pretty amazing what's happening. It's possible that it could end. You know, we don't know for sure. Is this actually the dawn of the Messianic Age? It sure seems like it. There are so many signs. But we know, I mean, even if you compare our feelings about Israel right now and our feelings about Israel 15 years ago, 15 years ago we were chugging along strong and everybody kind of took it for granted that we have it. And now there's a little worry, you know. Do we? Really? You know, will we still? You know, so we don't know for sure. So hopefully we'll get to 2/3 and to 100%. That'd be lovely. And we'll see. We don't know for sure yet.
I'm going to ask a question of clarification because I know that there are some Jews in Israel that do not, or even here, that do not recognize Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember why. I used to know why.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't. Do you know
yeah.
what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've been trying to make it,
but
I can't remember.
I do. So I'll just make that a very quick thing because it's a little bit longer. That's questions about Zionism. So the question is, and see if I can put it into all of this. Let me see. If I don't answer it, then make sure I answer it. But I'm going to try to just put it into something a little bit bigger. But let me give a little more context, okay? So the fact that that the Jews will be returning and we won't be exile creatures anymore, that we will function within our land. So let's just call that stage one. But that is only stage one in the dawning of the Messianic era. But really, it's because we are a chosen people and we have a destiny. We have a destiny and a mission, which is to reveal to all humanity its purpose and its power through ethical monotheism. That we are the leaders of the planet in teaching a system of ethical monotheism to all human beings, that is the way human beings should be relating to God, is through a system of ethical monotheism. And so we need to lead the way for that to happen. I'm just trying to think how to put that Israel piece in, but okay. The Messiah then will help us learn, because as you see today, we're chugging along very slowly with very few of us actually learning that mission and how to accomplish it. That we have one, what it is, and how to accomplish it, very few Jews. It's a very small percentage of Jews that know all three. Even that we have one, not all Jews know that. What it is, not all Jews know that, and certainly how to do it. And then the ability and the drive to behave in accordance with all that it takes to accomplish the mission, we're not there yet. So Mashiach is going to help with that. Mashiach is going to be, really, in a way, plus, but the Gandhi plus, the Martin Luther King plus, the charismatic leader of kindness, compassion, and drive that leads people, that shows people what it is and brings people to the ability to achieve that. And then that's going to bring the world to its own ability to recognize all humanity. It's going to be, there will be a clarity. Like the prophets say, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of God, like the water fills the seas. It'll be so obvious. There's not going to be any question like we today sit around with Christianity. Are they right? Aren't they right? People wonder, could it be? Is it possible? Did the Mashiach come? Does God exist? Doesn't God exist? Is science the right way to see the world? Is religion the right way? Like all these questions that people, why did the Holocaust happen? Is God there? Does God really care about the Jews? If he does, how can he let that happen? You know, like all these questions that we have, it's going to be so obvious. Once Mashiach comes, that it's not going to be a question. It's going to be as clear as it is night outside, as clear as it is day. It will be obvious to everyone, not just to the believers, to everyone on the planet. It will be obvious. And then that will usher in an era of peace. So let's go back and answer that Israel question. In order for this to happen, the Jews have a mission. They have to accomplish their mission. How do the Jews accomplish their mission? Our mission is a big mission. And so I want to try to give you a forest picture here, not a trees picture. So many times we look at trees in Judaism. Why Kashrus? Why Shabbos? Why holidays? Each holiday, right? And even chosen people are even bigger concepts. But what is the whole thing? The whole thing, the forest picture, the master plan of all Judaism. Here I'm going to reveal to you the actual real text of the protocols of the elders of Zion. We do have a conspiracy, and that's to bring the world to peace. That all human beings should be living in peace with each other, with their souls, and with God. So with self, God, and humanity, we should all be living in accordance with Torah values. Torah values are peace. Torah values are relationship with God. But how will we do that? It's not a relationship in the Himalayas. We're not meditators where we separate from the whole society and say that's how we live in peace, by withdrawal. We live in peace by engagement. So in order for the Jews to lead the world in a vision, a utopian vision of peace and synergy, we have to have a whole society that lives that way. So we have to have a concrete human government of a country, so that we can show people how a government should work, how a country should work, how technology should work, how a banking system should work, how clean energy should work, or whatever kind of energy we use, how it should all work. So for that, we need a country. And for that, we need that country. We need Israel. Israel is promised to the Jews. And if you think about where it's located really in, well, we call it the eye of the universe, the center of the world, but think about it. It's the bridge of three continents and an ocean. So you have a continent on one side, a continent on one side, a continent on the bottom, and an ocean, so that you're open to the whole world, so that the Jewish message is right there. Anybody who's got a camel team is going through, so they're going to hear the message of the Jews. But any trade route really goes through Israel. And fascinatingly, now that we're out of the whole camel mode, where is all the trade stuff coming out of? Israel. Israel is providing the technology to run the planet, right? Everything that connects people, Intel, and all the stuff that's being developed, not every drop of it, but so much of it, so much of what connects the planet, people to each other, is being developed in Israel. Israel is the center of connection of people to each other, and ultimately people to God, and people to their mission. All people have a mission of being in relationship with God and living in a way that's a healthy, good way that contributes to everybody in synergy. We're not supposed to be separated unto ourselves. So how do we accomplish that mission? We have to live in a land and have a normal life. Now, Jews could never have a normal life because we're not a normal people. We're born in miracles and we live in miracles. But that's what we need to teach, is that miracles are normal. God runs the world. And we Jews get that. We live in a God runs the world plan. And that's actually part of the reason, and unfortunately we've had to show the world this through suffering, but part of the reason that the Jews have suffered so much is to show how abnormal is that. Look at these people. Look what they've been through. And they still are here. And they're still attached. And they still have a message. And they really are, I mean, little glitches notwithstanding, the most peaceful people on the planet. I mean, look what we're accomplishing. We're an amazing people with tremendous goodness flowing out of us and tremendous technology and resources and innovations bubbling out of us constantly. And after what we've been through, and after 2,000 years of torture and going around the whole planet and not being connected to each other, we're still connected to each other, and we're still obviously the same people. And Shabbos in Bangkok is just the same as it is in India, is just the same as it is in Brooklyn, is just the same as it is in Alaska. It's the same thing. Everybody lights Shabbos candles and says Kiddush and has a meal and the same kinds of things. Maybe the fish is different. One place it's gefilte and one place it's more, you know, spicy or whatever it is, but there's the fish and the soup and the meal and the hot thing the next day. It's the same. And Havdalah is the same, and it's the same. We're one people. So, and we're showing the world and ourselves, miraculously, that we've made it through this history to bring this mission. Now, the question is Israel. So clearly Israel is an extremely important component of this. We have to have that land in that space. That land was promised to us by God in order to accomplish this mission. It has its own holy vibrations in it also that help us. Our sages even teach us that the air of Israel makes you smart. One time when I went to Israel, and when my kids were little and so sweet at the time, before they were corrupted by everything, so I asked them, what do you want from Israel? They said, bring us some air. The air of Israel makes you smart, and we want to be smart. So every water bottle that I emptied there, I just like went like this, and I filled it up and put on the cap tight, and I packed it, and I brought it home. And I brought it home. I had one for each kid, and I had them stand over and quickly open it up and squeeze it out so they could inhale the air of Israel. So, but the air of Israel makes you smart, and the air of Israel also, the land of Israel, helps one work on their spirituality. That's one reason why Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, wanted to go to Israel so badly. He clearly hit the rock. He had an anger problem, and he wanted to be able to work on it. And he had worked on it as much as he could himself. He understood that the land of Israel would help him accomplish what he couldn't accomplish on his own. He really wanted to go to be able to work on that problem. And that was denied him, but he did understand the concept of the land of Israel magnifies efforts. So it magnifies efforts for good, and it magnifies efforts for bad. So sins committed in the land of Israel are also magnified and very detrimental to the Jewish people and to the world. And mitzvahs done there are also magnified and increase goodness and positivity in the world. So the land itself has its own special power, in addition to being strategically located and important for the mission of the Jews to spread this to the planet. So now the question is, why are there some people who don't recognize the state? So first, we can look at the state and see. There's two main reasons. One is the actual reality of the state. Look at the state today. Is it a Torah society? It is not. Not at all. Is it a society of people who really understand their mission and are working hard together to spread that mission to the world? It is not, right? Herzl's dream was to be a nation like any other nation, and that is what we're trying to accomplish. Really, the mission of Zionism, secular Zionism, is to blend, right? Just to be a nation. The question that Herzl was trying to answer with Zionism was, how do we get out from this suffering? And that was the question of the late 1700s, early 1800s, with emancipation and science coming, and different countries deciding that there is such a thing as civil rights and granting it to whatever groups they chose to grant it to. Right, France was the first one to look at the Jews and grant Jews civil rights, and they said to the Jew as an individual, everything, but to the Jews as a people, nothing. So a Jew who would be a Frenchman of the Hebrew faith, they got civil rights. Right, so everybody was asking at the time, how do we bear the suffering that we have as Jews? So the Orthodox answered, faith. We understand there's a plan, we understand God runs the world, we take it even if we don't fully get why each situation is so difficult, but we can stand in this. And they strengthen themselves in faith. The nascent nationalists said, join a nation, still be Jewish, but give up the national dream of the Jew, the desire to return to Zion and be part of the country that you live in. So that was the French answer, the answer for the French Jews. The reform movement started then and said, the answer is stop being so Jewish. Be a man on the street and a Jew in your house. Switch your prayer times to Sunday mornings. Put an organ in. Make a cathedral instead of a little schlumpy shul. You know, make it gorgeous and be like everybody else. Just be Jewish, a little Jewish, not too Jewish, right? Another answer, another answer was convert to Christianity, right? Just dump the whole Jewish thing. Become Christian. And so a lot of people did that too. A lot of people who sought positions in universities or positions writing music or conducting orchestras, you know, they had to do that also. Then secularism began, and it became possible for the first time in the history of the world to not be religious. So an answer was assimilate and just blend. You don't have to be Christian. You don't have to be a Frenchman of the Hebrew faith. You could just be a blend. And that was Herzl's tactic. Herzl said, I'm going to blend. I'm not even going to... He didn't even circumcise his own kids.
But wasn't that the same as the Maccabees were fighting against for Hanukkah?
No. It was a little different than that, and that's a longer tangent, so I'm probably not going to go there right now. Ask it again at the end.
No,
it was a different kind of assimilation.
Colonization
that was assimilation like converting to Christianity. That was buying into their program.
Oh,
this Herzl's was just blend. Like today, we've got a lot of just blended Jews, right? I'm just a human being, right? Just. And not identifying with anything. I'm just, right? That this is a new phenomenon. You couldn't do this 300 years ago. There was no just citizen of the universe reality at all whatsoever. You had to belong to a group. But in Herzl's time, in the 1850s-ish, he believed that the answer to that painful Jewish question of how do I get out from under this was just blend. And that's what he tried to do. And then he went, he saw the Dreyfus trial, and he saw that in France, the first country that offered Jews civil rights, there was this sham trial, and Dreyfus was convicted, and now the response on the street was death to the Jews. And he realized there is no escaping it. You're a Jew, you're a Jew, you're a Jew no matter what. And so he came up with a new answer. And the new answer is we have to be like everybody else. We have to have, we'll be recognized if we have our own country and our own army and our own government and we take our place among the nations. So Herzl's dream of Zionism was straight up, how do I get out from under this, had nothing to do with Judaism. Nothing. So nothing to do with Judaism that he was willing to take Uganda as the Jewish homeland. His idea was just make us normal. Give us a country with an army and a government so we'll be normal. So for that reason, many Jews of any Jewish value, who had any Jewish value in them, said, this is not Jewish. This program is not Jewish. What you're thinking isn't Jewish, and we oppose it. So that was reason one to not accept the initial state. But that started it, and it chugged along. And then with that, you had the socialists and the communists and all the nationalistic stuff that was going on and all the things that were happening in Europe. And so it was basically the secular Jews, the Yiddishists and the socialists and the communists, who went to Israel to make a state for themselves, to create the socialist experiment, a secular socialist experiment. So that's reason number two why not accept the state. But the theological reason for not accepting the state was that a covenant was made between God, the Jews, and the nations. Now, how this covenant was made, I'm not exactly sure, but it's recorded in the Talmud that there's a covenant between God, the Jews, and the nations where God says, I, to the Jews, you're going into exile. My part of the covenant is I won't let you disappear. Nations, your part of the covenant is you won't torture them too much. You can torture them, but not too much. And Jews, you won't break down the wall to come back to Israel. Whatever that means, break down the wall. That's how it's phrased.
You will not
break down the wall to return to Israel. So that was the problem. In the 1850s already, or a little bit later, in the 1870s, when things really started to happen, Jews really were going back to Israel. There really did be, you know, in the 1880s, I think, was the first Aliyah, right? So really people were really going. That's when the Satmar Rebbe already said, this is in violation of breaking down the wall. This is too many people. We've always had a presence in the land of Israel. There always should be Jews there. It's fine if there's a trickle of the pious and the saintly who are willing to go there and struggle in life and die there. That's fine. But to create a whole society there, this is in violation of that promise. And so...
Who's saying that?
The Satmar Rebbe said that. Satmars are still against the state of Israel today. But he said that's in violation of the promise. He said, don't go. So some religious didn't go, and some did. But the state, so at the same time as he's saying don't go, there's a theological problem. At the same time, they're establishing basically a very secular state. A very secular state. I mean, it's proactively secular. Right? And so much so that after the establishment of the state of Israel, when it's all run by the secular Ashkenazic elite, and all the Jews from the Arab lands come and they're all religious, their religion is stolen from them at the gates of Israel. Even to the point where, it's amazing, in the Ma'abarot, in those camps, the tent camps where the Sephardim, where the Moroccans and the Yemenites and those the Persians stayed in these tent encampments in the early 1950s, mid-1950s when they came, and it was miserable conditions. I mean, just really, they all lived in tents and in squalor. and freezing cold and no money. They came with nothing. They came completely poverty-stricken. And the same amount that came was the amount of Jews who were in the land who received them. So Israel absorbed its entire population, basically, of penniless immigrants from Arab lands. So, but these penniless immigrants came religious and came interested. And so, but the Ashkenazic government did not want to change Israel into a religious society. So some of the yeshivas would send students to get some of the boys and say, come to our yeshiva. You'll sleep under a roof instead of in a tent. And the people who ran the camps said, you send a boy to yeshiva and nobody in your family gets winter clothes. Not one. That'll be the price. And they had policies like that across the board, where the Jewish government enforced a policy of no religion in this country. So we clearly see a policy of establishing a secular state had nothing to do with the Jewish vision of the return to Zion. This Zionism initially did not have to. Then there became a divergent stream called religious Zionism, which really is religious Torah-based concepts that you should be living in the land of Israel to do mitzvahs there, and we should establish a society, and it's best for Jews to have a presence in the land and control over the land.
What time factor was it that the, quote, Jewish government wouldn't allow, or, you know, would not give them clothing, you know, the families?
The early years of the state, and even, like, with the Yemenites, I mean, there's this whole...
So 1949?
Yeah, through the 50s, yeah. I mean, even the Yemenites, they kidnapped their babies. They would tell the Yemenite women that their baby died at birth in the hospital because, you know, they used to knock women out when they gave birth. And they would just say, you had a stillbirth. And they'd give the baby away to an Ashkenazic family to be raised secular.
Okay.
I mean, it's like a very serious policy of secularizing the Sephardim, which is why today it's fascinating to see a huge difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim worldwide, but certainly in Israel, is the Sephardim are the traditional ones. And if you offer them Judaism, they will take it back. So those who go knocking on doors saying, do you want to learn for an hour? They knock on a Sephardic door, and the guy will answer the door in his, you know, with a beer in his T-shirt and say, sure, and turn off the TV and sit for an hour, because his Judaism was stolen from him or from his father, and he'll take it back if you hand it to him. But the Ashkenazim themselves crumpled it up and threw it away. So you first have to convince an Ashkenazi, go look for it in the garbage, take it out, clean it off, open it up, and then think about it if you want it. So it's a whole different process, bringing Sephardic Jews closer and Ashkenazic Jews closer. Completely different process. So, now we're engaged in this theological battle. What should be done with the state until 1948? Right. Once the state is established, then the theological battle is over, basically, because the state's been established. So there was a lot of fighting and a lot of anti-Zionism among the right-wing religious Jews not to establish the state, because they felt it was in violation of the promise of not to break down the wall. Once it was a fact on the ground, most people acquiesced to the existence of the state. A few said, we still don't agree with the state at all. I'll live here. It's the holy land. But I won't pay taxes and I won't take anything from the government either. So there's a very few people who are in that category today. But there are a few, maybe numbered in the hundreds, low hundreds, I would think. But there are some today. But basically everybody else realizes this is the state. And people definitely see the miracles in its establishment. It's pretty hard to deny the miracles that went into establishing the state of Israel. So people recognize that it is miraculous, and so modern Orthodox Jews, as distinguished from right-wing Orthodox Jews, believe that this is the flowering of the third redemption, that these miracles add up to Mashiach is coming. And so it's now our job. So now take from modern Orthodox another stream, the settlers, right? And even the state was pro-settler. I mean, I served in the Israeli army in 1982, and I was a settler. That was a state job, right? That's when settlers were heroes, and settlements were a good thing. So the government funded setting them up, and there's a whole branch of the army whose job it was to set up settlements. So, and I was in that part, and girls who were in that, was they got 2 months of basic training instead of 3 weeks because they might be attacked. So you had to know 3 guns and chemical warfare defense and a few extra things, you know, so that you could start an outpost in the middle of nowhere. But so the state was with that program too, settle the land of Israel. It was a holy thing to do. So now it's only a religious thing to do. It's not a secular holy thing to do. But it was part of the secular holiness also. So that's a whole other long conversation, but that's kind of a medium-sized answer to your question. Not short, but not long enough for sure. Okay, so looking back at Mashiach then, make sure I leave enough time for the other things. So what Mashiach is supposed to do is bring us the era preceding Mashiach. Jews will be returning to the homeland. Then he'll help us understand that we have a special destiny and mission. It'll make it clear for all of us. And then he'll bring the full infrastructure of Judaism, the forest picture, to the Jews and in the land. So that the land of Israel, so even if it's the current state, and I certainly hope, if not, I'm on the edge of belief, but I definitely hope very strongly that this state of Israel is the beginning of the final redemption. We have a ways to go in terms of establishing a forest picture of Judaism there, but that Mashiach will help shape things up, that the government will run according to Torah and the people will run according to Torah. It won't be a scary theocracy. It'll be everything works well, the ultimate view of what it's supposed to be, of everything working in according to Torah principles because Mashiach came, which is why we're not establishing a theocracy now. People are people, and people who think they know what God wants can do bad stuff. So, but Mashiach will be one who knows what God wants, and the whole world will see it. So it'll be obvious. It'll be a different paradigm of government. And then helping the whole world see that their purpose is to be in a relationship with God. And so the Jews will learn. I'm not even exactly sure exactly how it will work. Will the Jews learn first? Will it only be the Jews who know already? But somehow the Jews will be the teachers of the rest of the world. So, but the rest of the world will want to be taught by the Jews and will come to the Jews to learn. So we already see little bits and pieces of that, like kind of if you imagine this day as the sun, you're seeing tips of rays, but they're fuzzy tips of rays, you know, like interest in Kabbalah. You know, what is that? Non-Jewish interest in Kabbalah. So it is, but only the fuzzy edges of tips, because it's not really true. But it is people saying, Jews, you have something interesting. I want to learn what that is. Right? But they're not actually learning what it is. But still, it is an awakening around the planet of, and now there's a whole Musar movement that non-Jews are interested in as well. So character development, which is a little more real than the Kabbalah thing. The Kabbalah thing was mysticism without any basis to it. The Musar thing is character development without actually Judaism. I mean, a lot of what's going on in the Musar movement, there's real Musar, but I'm saying the more commercial Musar stuff is actually working on yourself, but not really with mitzvahs.
What's a Musar?
Musar is character development. I mean, that's a shallow translation of what Musar is. But it's the Torah's science for helping Torah learning affect you personally. Because it is possible for one to learn Torah and not become a good person, right? So the bridge between the intellectual and how you behave is Musar. So it's, again, weakly translated as character development. One has to become an appropriate vessel to receive water. So Torah is considered like water in that it's life-giving, but also water doesn't have a shape. So water takes on the shape of what it's poured into. So if we don't become a beautifully shaped vessel, the Torah that's poured into us will be ugly, right? So Musar helps us shape a vessel that makes the Torah that's in us beautiful. So people can work on Musar, just being nice, kind, thoughtful, whatever it is. And there are definitely, there's a Torah pathway to work on those things. But there is a Musar movement now that's kind of divorced from the whole Torah system. So, but it's better than Kabbalah, you know. I mean, it's an actual system of working on oneself. It just, you can't access the whole thing without the whole system. Anyway, so the whole world will see that, and that will bring us unto a whole peace, that the world will be working not just in the absence of war, but in synergy. Everybody then will get it, that we're working together, and we have rays of that too. Having a thing called the United Nations, for all the negative stuff that it does, at least there's a concept on the planet that nations should work together. Right? And we're not there yet, but it's a concept, and it is the beginning of what it says in Isaiah, that we'll beat our swords into plowshares, right? So that we should eventually, and we're not there yet, but we at least sort of have a vision. We're coming to a vision that war is not the way. You know, if we want to do war, we're just going to kill everybody. And that really we should be using the brain power that we have to create peace together. And that then the whole world can be fed and happy and healthy, and if we work together. So we're not there yet, but we see the edges of those rays beginning to shine from this era of Mashiach. Okay, so that's Mashiach. Now quickly to resurrection. Now, resurrection and the world to come kind of go together along with Mashiach. So let me put it into a big view here. The whole world was created for human beings to receive goodness from God. The way that they can receive goodness, the best good that they can receive, the best way to receive goodness is through a relationship with God. Because God is the best good that there is. If God wants to give good, God wants to give God's self. The way one gives oneself is through relationship. So God created a planet in which people could be in relationship with God to receive good. The whole purpose of everything is good. And yet we see on this planet that it's not so good. So this is really, the philosophers teach us that there are two stages to creation. We're in stage one, this world stage. This is the world where we build that relationship. And then comes that world stage. That's the world where we live in that relationship. So in this world, we're working towards creating a relationship. And in that world, we dwell in the relationship. What's going to dwell in that relationship, though? It's going to be our soul, not our body. Because that world is a spiritual world. This world is the physical and spiritual mixed together. This is a physical world. But we human beings are the only creature that has physical and spiritual mixed into one being. Right? So above us, there's angels. And below us, there's animals. And we're right in between because we're both.
This is off topic, that's fine, but I always have trouble with the idea that when God created the earth, according to the Torah, it included the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. and never, well, maybe God knew, but the rest of us, the whole rest of the world changed after Adam and Eve ate the apple, mm-hmm. and therefore it wasn't the earth that God created, it was a transformation of...
Okay, that's an excellent question. So what was that dynamic of Adam and Eve's ability to transform the entire world? So certainly God created a world in which free will needed to exist, right? So because the strongest relationship is built from free will. So in order for there to be free will, God has to actually pull his will out of the way a little bit. So he had to empower human beings to make choices. So it's sort of like, and you can just take this as a parable. It means you have to go further than this because it's not this. But it's sort of like a computer game, right? So in a computer game, everything has already been thought of. When you make a decision in that game, it just feeds you into the next set of things according to that decision that you made, right? If you would have made the other decision, it would have fed you into another branch of that program. But it's all been programmed out. Each decision brings you to another place where these are the new possibilities now because of that decision. So it is the world that God created. God said plan A is they don't eat from this, and they bring Mashiach right away by using their free will to do a positive action of refraining from what I told them to refrain from, and that will bring the world to its destiny, and we're done. That's all we need is for human beings to engage their free will to create a relationship with God, and that's it. So that was plan A. But plan B was put into place at creation, because otherwise there's no room for free will. If they only can choose plan A, then what? So plan B was... should they make the other choice, because that choice is available to them, then a different world will exist. But the potential for both were created at the same time. So this is the world that God created. But it isn't the world God hoped for, so to speak. Right? But we will be brought so it's just a much longer path. There was the short path to completion. We're on the super long, long path. But the destination is the same. And destination is what destiny is all about, right? Destiny is bringing us to our destination. Destination is all human beings in relationship with God to the extent that they choose. So, and Jews being the leaders and teachers of that. Okay, he'll dream good dreams. So the world to come is really once we've arrived at that destination. That destination is only after this whole planet, not after the death in let's just 1,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 100 years ago. People die at different times in history. They're not in the world to come yet. The world to come is after this world is done. So there's a soul holding zone where souls wait for the ultimate world to come. And that's a whole other long thing. So I could someday tell you about the soul holding zone. That's a kind of a more mystical thing. But the concept is that there is a world to come. That's where we receive the pleasure. That's where we live in the relationship. In order to receive the ultimate pleasure there, we have to be pleasure-receiving beings and pleasure-only receiving beings. Now, many of us will create a relationship with God on this planet that is similar to our marriages and friendships, which means it's a mixed bag, right? Nobody creates a perfect relationship pretty much with anybody, right? And so too with God. So bad is a construct that's necessary to allow free choice, but good is eternal. Good will last forever. So the good part of our relationship that we create with God will last forever. And the amount of good that we create is the level of relationship we'll live in forever in the world to come. But the bad has to end somehow, has to be removed from us somehow. So that brings us to both Gehenna and resurrection. Okay, the soul can't accomplish anything without a body. And a body without a soul is an animal. So the body cannot be held to account, it can't be judged for anything without a soul to inform it, because otherwise it just acts by instinct, right? You can't really yell at your dog for, again, licking the butter, which my dog does regularly, right, off the butter dish, because that's its instinct. It's yummy, it wants it, it takes it. If you're not looking, it takes it. You know, that's just how animals are, right? Or if they chew up, I don't know, somebody's black hat that they set on a table instead of on a high shelf. So then the owners just have to buy a new black hat, I'm speaking from experience, for their friend, right? And they learn to put hats up because you can't blame the dog. They just like to eat things and it smelled good. So, right? But if it's a human being, you can. You can say you should have known better, right? You don't take other people's stuff. You don't ruin other people's stuff. It's not okay because you have a soul. That's why you can take a human being to task for it. That's why there's an insanity defense. Insanity defense is they didn't really get it. They didn't have the capacity to really understand what they were doing. But if you have the capacity to understand, you can be held to account. So it's the body that does good things and bad things, which then affects the soul. It's the soul that causes the body to do those things. So the body and the soul work together. The soul can't achieve without the body. So when the person needs to be judged for what they did in this world so that the negativity can be removed and so that the final state of the person can be decided, they cannot be judged as a soul. Right? So all these souls, all these people have died. Their bodies have been planted in the earth or whatever's happened to them. And the souls go to the soul holding zone, and whatever happens there happens, and that's a whole long story. But the soul can't be judged at the end of days. There's a judgment right at death. What did you accomplish in this lifetime? But what you accomplished in this lifetime has a lot of ripple effects throughout lifetimes. So there has to be a judgment at the end of the whole planet. At the end of days, you have to be judged again. But it's not really fair to judge the soul alone because it did its work with a body. Hence resurrection. So there is a resurrection where bodies and souls are put back together for judgment. So, and the body that the soul was put back in, it's a whole long process, and I wish we had a long time to discuss it. But the actual body is, the body that we have now does not reflect our soul state. But the body of resurrection will be similar to the body of the initial Adam and Eve, which is a physical body that does reflect the soul state. So what will be resurrected in a way, and this is, again, just a way of thinking about it. Nobody knows exactly, but a concept of what will happen is somehow there'll be a physical lump that is brought back or might be a light body which is still physical. And then the soul is dropped into it. I imagine like two Alka-Seltzer tablets, right? So it's dropped in, it fizzes up, and then the body is transformed instantly to reflect the soul state. That's actually, in a way, the beginning of the Gehenna process, because then we'll be able to look at each other and absolutely understand with total clarity who did what, who accomplished what, who achieved a spiritual level and who didn't, whose bodies are perfected, whose hands are strong because they gave and they helped, and whose aren't fully developed, who's missing fingers because they didn't use their fingers for mitzvahs. You know, so that there, that will be, and the, so there'll be part of the fire of Gehenna or of hell is the shame and the embarrassment that people will feel as they reflect what their soul actually looks like and they see where they are in accordance with others. There will be an uncomfortable place, not just in reflection with others, but in reflection with self when we realize, oh my gosh, I could have achieved X, but what I did achieve was X minus whatever. So, or I don't know if there's ever an X plus, but at least we could get to X. Yeah, what's
so
your question?
We believe in reincarnation.
Yes, we do. Which is separate from resurrection.
But when you're talking about, so in this body, with my soul now, I do good. In a previous life, with, I would presume, the same soul, but a different body, I don't do good. How does that...
Right, it's very, very complicated mathematics. So even if you want to say, let's make it easy for just a minute, and then I'll make it more complicated. So, okay, so this soul in this body does whatever it does in this world, right? So then how does that reconcile with this soul in a different body, right? And we do have reincarnation, so I'll just give you a for instance story. Like, let's say somebody in the Spanish Inquisition is brought to the cross and said, convert or die, and they choose convert, right? So now they have to be resurrected, they have to be reincarnated, so they have, and maybe they're reincarnated as a Christian. So they have an option to be able to move towards Judaism or convert back, right? So maybe they're that same Jewish soul born into a Christian body, they have to convert back, or somehow they have to make a tikkun for what they did. So there's that type of thing that can happen, but there could be somebody who is evil in one lifetime and good in another lifetime, and every lifetime is a mixture. Every lifetime is a mixture. So the conglomeration of all the lifetimes together are what affects that soul. So, and then the resurrection won't be, because a lot of times people say, well, which body then is resurrected? If you're reincarnated a lot of times, so then which body is it that's resurrected? So that's why I said it's like a lump. It's not that this body rises from the grave, although there's something that's connected to this body, sort of like planting a tulip. You plant the bulb, and in the spring you see a flower. That flower is not that bulb. If you dig up the bulb, you won't see a flower. But the flower is still related to the bulb, right? So the body, the resurrected physical thing, it will be related to that which was planted. And that's one reason why we have bulbs and springtime, to help us see what looks like death. The trees look so dead with nothing on them. They look dead, and yet life flows again. And we see that every year, so that we can try to understand the concept of planting something that breaks down and looks like nothing, and then it will blossom again.
So if the resurrection... Point about the reincarnation, yeah, like which body would you have?
Mm-hmm.
If it's just something that's sort of connected in a conceptual way that we can't really think of what it is, then why is it forbidden to be cremated?
Because we still do respect, similar to mezuzahs or Torah scrolls or sitters or tzitzis that we use for holy purposes, we respect them. We don't just chuck them, we don't burn them, we bury them. So our body was used to house the soul. Was used for a holy purpose. We treat it with respect, and that is the respect. But we also prepare it, and we do prepare it for resurrection. So the whole washing of a body and the preparation that's done at death before the body is planted is all about preparing this seed for regrowth at some point. So, and we don't know exactly. So that's why I said that. So there's this simple math, right, of body and resurrection. And we just talked about a simple math of soul, but let's make it more complicated. So the body, we don't know which body is going to come up or exactly what's going to happen, or is the body related to it, and it's all miracles. Because even a body that was burned in the ovens in Auschwitz is going to be resurrected, right? So the whole thing is a miracle in the first place. But it's no more miraculous than birth. I mean, how much of a miracle is that, where two little cells come together and make a whole human being with everything, right? It's totally, totally miraculous. Really, our whole lives are miraculous. And as Jews, as I said before, we live in miracles. So if we fully get, which takes a lifetime of thought, to fully get that everything is miraculous, then resurrection is totally normal. Right? We're just living. That's the way it works, right? You plant and it comes back, right? And it's reborn and it's fresh. So who knows what the math is exactly? God knows the math exactly of how the body is resurrected and what parts of the body, is it a piece from each one? That's why Adam was made from dust from all around the planet. Like, really? I mean, is it a piece of dust from each one? Like, so that's up to God to decide how he wants to do that miracle. A miracle is done. And a body comes back and the soul goes into it. Now let's think about the soul for a second. Is it the same soul? And this goes to your question about Adam and Eve. So we have a concept that there's a proto-soul of all humanity, right? So your question really is this the world that God created? But a question that a lot of people have is, why should I live in the shadow of what Adam decided? I have to live and suffer because Adam and Eve made a mistake. Is that fair? So we have a concept of proto-soul, that Adam and Eve were the soul of all humanity, and they're all soul splinters from that. But then we have a concept of Jewish soul as separate from proto-soul. So all humanity is soul splinters of Adam and Eve, and then a soul splinter, Abraham, elevates and becomes... It's okay. The Jewish... I'm just glad it wasn't my phone. Becomes the Jewish concept, the Jewish soul, and we have a concept of 600,000 Jewish souls. Clearly, there's more than 600,000 Jews alive today, and there's been more than 600,000 Jews alive altogether in the history of the world. So there's soul splinters there, too. So is it your exact soul that was reincarnated? Or was it a combination of yours and mine? Or little soul flickers of a bunch around? You know, the math is much more complicated than it sounds like. You know, it's not just my soul gets reincarnated, and we're splinters of different things. That's why when some people do past life work, for whatever it's worth, and I think in some places it's worth, in some places it's not, a lot of people could be Miriam. Do you always notice how people are always somebody famous in the past? Always, right? But you may have another one too where you were a peasant, but for sure you were somebody famous, right? But maybe you were. Maybe there are 100 people, 1,000 people that were Miriam, right? Or Moshe or whatever, because they're soul splinters. And there's mixtures of it, which is one reason why we Jews really get, we are one family. We're not just one family. We're one soul. That's one reason why we're so careful not to accept converts easily. We only take converts who want to be, that we want, and who really want to be part of the Jewish soul. Because it's one soul. And we have enough energy drains, really, on our one soul. We don't need to add more. We need to shore it up. And so we all work together to create a one family vision, and we take care of each other. That's why we all felt horrified over Mbai. That's why we all feel, we don't think about it all the time, but when we do, we feel terrible about Gilad Shalit all by himself, away from his family. How sad is that? We don't feel as sad for every prisoner on the planet, but Gilad Shalit, we're thinking about, oh my gosh, he's been away from his family for 3 years. He's growing up and his parents are separate from him. He's separate from his parents. It's tragic because he's our brother. We feel it, you know, and the same simcha that we can feel over Hani Sarah Bransky, who had twins, you know, and how wonderful that whole story is. If you don't know that story, it's such a great story, but that somebody who, in response to the Mumbai murders, a reproductive endocrinologist said, I think it was five Jews. Five Jews were taken out of the world. I want to put five Jews back. I think it was seven, actually. And so he said, find me seven Jews who can't afford treatments anymore, and I will help them. And so Chani Sarah Bransky was one of them. And in the middle of her treatment, her mother died, and she had to go sit Shiva. And so she said, I'm sorry, I can't let go with the procedure. You know, it's been, she had a 10-year-old and then nothing. I can't do the procedure because I have to go sit Shiva. And he said, where are you sitting Shiva? He said, I will find a doctor there who will do it for free for you. And that's where she conceived, and she had twin girls. So one for Mbani and one for her mother. It's just like, but how happy does that make you feel? Like, you don't know who she is, really, and even if you do, but like, somebody conceived twins because we're a family, you know, and somebody reached out to a family member because we're one soul. So the soul math is very complicated. It's not as easy as you think at all. Yeah.
I've heard a concept that it's better for us as a Jew to pray, but better to pray in a with 10 other people or within a congregation. Is that part of the concept here? Is it you're becoming more?
It is part of the concept because the good combines and the bad does not. So when a Jew prays on their own, they pray with their own merits, their own positive and their own negative. But when they pray with others, all the positive combines, but the negative remains with you. So you combine, your prayer is much more powerful because it combines with the positivity of everybody in the room who's praying together. But the negative does not combine, that remains individual. So that's just...
And do you receive some of the positive?
Yeah, so all of that, then yeah, so then that all goes together. Does it transfer into you? Well, prayer...
A little bit of the positive, yeah. Really great positive.
Yeah, it does. It generates positive, which affects all people all on the entire planet.
Okay.
So, but that, it's if somebody, let's say somebody's not praying with as much intent as they might, but that prayer is more easily carried, so to speak, to where it needs to go, whatever that means, because other people have their power in it. So so it is advantageous to pray with others.
Just quickly, in Israel they have a lot of graves that were on top of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because they wanted to make sure they were...
I don't know if the graves were on top of the ground or just the stones look like
okay,
they
well,
are.
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they actually are. I think they are buried underneath. Okay. There's all kinds of weird things about the resurrection. One reason why people like to be buried in the land of Israel is because there is a thought that the resurrection happens in Israel only. Not that those outside won't be resurrected, but here's the woo-woo stuff. There'll be a rolling underground of the bodies to get to Israel, and they'll be resurrected from there. And the rolling will be uncomfortable or painful, whatever. So that there are those, right, who want to be buried in Israel. They don't have to do that.
They
don't have to travel as far. Right. So who knows what that is, but that certainly is a thought. Right. That is a thought.
And just one more question. Hell is then judgment.
Hell is Gehenna. First of all, heaven and hell, so the world to come, is the experience of the relationship that we have with God. If we have a good relationship, it's heaven. If we have a bad relationship, it's hell. Okay? It could be a relatively neutral relationship too, so then it's kind of nothing-ish. But it is the experience of the relationship. What we call Gehenna is a hospital experience, a short-term tumor removal place where we have the negative removed from us. So just like nobody wants to go to the hospital and be cut open and have part of their body removed and have to experience the pain of recovery from the stitches and all that stuff, but they still, when the doctor does that to them, they still say, thank you, right? Because they appreciate that that was for their best. So Gehenna's the same way. A very uncomfortable, but it's surgery. It's important, but it's painful. You want it. You don't want it. Nobody wants cancer. Nobody wants a tumor. So if you could live a life that doesn't create spiritual tumors, much better, right? But if you lived a life that created them, so what? You're not going to have eternal bliss because you did, you know, bad stuff here and you're held back from it? No, God is very kind. He set up a program where that can be taken care of through difficulty. So you have difficulty in this world. And then if that didn't take care of it, and sometimes that does take care of it, then there's Gehenna after we die that takes care of the rest of it, whatever the rest is. And then a person is completely purged of whatever it is, and off they go to eternity. So and live in whatever amount of good they created. You don't get more good out of that. It's the same amount of good, but you have to have the bad removed because bad is temporal and good is permanent. So, I hope that puts it all kind of into context. You can ask more questions if you want, but that's the end of the mystical portion of TJU.